Just a quick note before we start to say that we're expanding the ways in which listeners can get the premium version of the Election Tricycle. So not only can you get it through Emily's premium Substack, you can now go to the-election-tricycle.hubwave.net, and that's a premium subscription service for podcasts for £5 a month or whatever the equivalent is in your currency. You can get all the premium episodes of the podcast and help support the show. Poddo.
You're listening to the Election Tricycle with Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin, and Rohan Venkat.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Election Tricycle. I'm Emily Tamkin in Washington, D.C. I'm joined by my co-hosts Rohan and Tom in Cairo and London, respectively. Each week on this podcast, we talk about three elections that are happening here in 2024 in the United States, India, and the United Kingdom, with some other stops along the way. This week, as promised, if you listened to last week's episode, we are going to take you through how our elections work with a particular focus on India's elections, because the dates were just announced. Rohan, can you remind us when the elections will be held? And you mentioned last week, I think, that the dates that they're held and the dates that we know are quite different. Can you explain why that is? So when and why?
Thank you, Emily. We always get this big load of headlines about India's elections, which were announced a week and a half ago. They start on April 19th, but they go all the way to June 1st, and we're only going to get counting on June 4th. And you get all these stories about a seven-phase election, a 44-day-long election, which often, I think, tends to confuse people, long period of elections beginning April 19th, so we're just around the corner from them, and maybe because I've been used to Indian elections all my life, they're not actually that complicated, but they certainly sound quite different to what you guys are used to in both of your countries.
Yeah. So when you say there are seven different phases, if I've understood it right, it's not that anyone is voting seven times. It's that there are geographical splits when the voting happens. So everyone votes once, but they just do it over a really long period. Is that right? And why is that?
Yeah, exactly, Tom. I think for folks who are more used to systems where you have a runoff and that kind of thing, it almost sounds like an extremely complicated thing. But actually, it's quite straightforward, except it's just stretched over India's geography and India's massive electorate. India has 970 million registered voters this time around, and actually pulling things off in a country of this size is quite complex. So to strip it down to basics, India has a Westminster-style democracy, which means we have 543 seats in the lower house of parliament, which is what people are voting for this time. You vote for your member of parliament, of which, as I mentioned, there's 543. We have a simple first-past-the-post system, which means that whoever gets the most votes, doesn't matter whether they have 50 or 21, you know, if they have one more vote than the other person, they win. And those 540 individual elections make up who comes to power, because then whoever has the most seats in parliament wins. Just the big difference is that it's massive. I looked up the numbers a little bit here. My understanding is the average parliamentary constituency in the UK is about 70,000 voters or so. Yeah. The average congressional race, which I think would be the equivalent in the US, is about 700,000 voters. And in India, the average constituency is 1.5 million voters. And some of those are as big as going up to 3 million voters in one constituency, which is bigger than the size of entire electorates in other parts of the world. Added to that, the sheer complexity of India's geography, a past where you've had violence and you know, electoral drama in terms of booth capturing or even terrorist attacks. And so you have to have security forces across the country. That's partly the reason why we have such a long extended election.
And just to be clear, it's not the case that you sort of know as you go. So for example, this is not a one-to-one comparison at all, but for the US primary system, for example, like you know which candidates win which states, and that maybe you can say, all right, that like if one candidate does really well in, I don't know, New Hampshire, maybe that changes how things go in South Carolina. That's not the case here, right?
Yeah, exactly. So when elections are announced, there's something called the Model Code of Conduct, which comes into place, which means that governments at the central level, but elsewhere also, cannot announce any new major initiatives, which, you know, basically do not allow whoever's in power to get any sort of advantage. But the Model Code of Conduct also means that results or opinion polls, that sort of thing, cannot happen over the course of this period. And so as the first set of voters in one part of the country go out and vote on April 19th, we're not going to get those results until the very end. Officially and formally, you know, news, you know, the news can't report on, even if people have done, for example, sampling, exit polling, as we say, people coming out of the booths, there is this is happening, but it's not legal for us to tell you what those sampling reports tell us. That said, there's always, you know, buzz, what in India is called the hawa, you know, which hawa means the atmosphere, the sort of sense of who is doing better this time, who is doing worse this time. And because these happen one after the other, there definitely is the potential for some parties to say, oh, we did so great in phase one and phase two and phase three, and for momentum to build and, you know, gather, use that to get more people out, or to say, oh, we're not doing so well and we need more people to show up. So officially, we won't get any results until counting starts on the 4th of June, but there'll definitely be buzz over the next month or so, even as we wait for the official results.
And sorry, just one other technical question. You know, in the United States, and we'll speak about this more when the U.S. election comes closer, but it sort of varies by state to state how you're allowed to vote, when you have to register to vote. You know, some states have same day voting, some don't. States have mail in voting, but the time by which you have to send in your ballot varies by state to state. When those ballots are counted varies by states to state. Right? Are they counted before the election? Are they counted only after the election? Or like on election night actually. Is there that kind of variety between states in India, or is it uniform across the country? This is how we vote.
Yeah, it's relatively uniform. Let's say that the central government, India has a more centralized form of federalism than the US has. And the central government pulls off or runs the general elections, as we call them. There are a few instances where there are mail-in ballots. It's not widely used in India. It's for specific use cases like the armed forces or central government employees that have been deputed in other parts of the country. But by and large, most voting takes place physically using electronic voting machines, and everything is counted starting June 4th on counting day. There's very, very little variation except for a few exceptions involving, you know, like I said, the armed forces and things. And actually, one of the interesting things, it just reminds me of what you asked, one of the interesting reasons why we have this long, prolonged election is that there's a law that requires a voting booth to be within 2 kilometers of any registered voter. So just to make it possible for people around the country to vote, you have to have a voting booth close enough to them. And so you have these fascinating stories every election. Last general election, my colleagues at Scroll.in, where I worked, reported on an election team that trekked for 2.5 days up into Arunachal Pradesh, this Himalayan state, to get to one voter who lived in this village there who was still registered. And so you always have these incredible stories of teams traveling, you know, deep into parts of the country just to get to that singular voter. And that also explains to some extent why it's so long. But there are, and we can talk about this potentially, critiques of such a long election as well.
Yeah. I had a couple of questions about, one is about the security challenge of having ballot boxes with votes in them for potentially as long as 7 weeks. And does that cause issues? Are there any attempts ever to tamper with those votes or to cause problems in a way that, I mean, there are vote tampering efforts in almost every election in every part of the world, but normally you don't have 7 weeks to do it in. And then the other question I had was about this buzz that people have, where you can say, you know, we did really well in this first set. We think our momentum is building. Is there any evidence of of parties saying that and either getting it wrong or just making it up, or a combination of the two?
So to the first question, remarkably, I'd say by and large, Indian elections have been, especially in the last few cases, have shown themselves to be quite robust. India moved a couple of decades ago to electronic voting machines rather than paper ballots. But they use a particularly low-cost, low-tech version that's not networked at all. So they're not connected to the internet or anything. They're individual boxes. And so to tamper with each one, you'd have to tamper with each one individually. Rather, you couldn't just stick a virus in them. There have been allegations from opposition groups of tampering of these. There have been some questionable cases where we have seen, you know, BJP leaders, for example, riding in the cars with the election commission officials, taking these machines somewhere. There is a way of attempting to check that the button that you press is actually what the machine records. There's something called a VVPAT. It's a slightly complex thing, but the machine prints out a small paper thing just to confirm to you that the button you pressed has resulted in the vote that you wanted it to vote. Because in a couple of weird cases, the last election around, we had things where whatever button you pressed, it went to one party. So there are allegations, but by and large, not proven. And of course, compared to the previous system, when there were paper ballots, those were much more easy to tamper with and also to commandeer. Where you'd physically, in some cases in India in the 80s and 90s, have people with guns show up to the booths, pick them up, and then stuff the ballots. And, you know, that sort of classic thing. It's we don't really see that at least at a large scale in India. Of course, every election, there are some allegations about these things. That said, I would say, you know, my reporting and that done by colleagues is that the Election Commission of India has not been very forthcoming with some of the details of how the machines are built, manufactured, and structured. And so there's still questions about how robust the systems are. But by and large, I would say there's no large-scale concerns about the tampering at this level. The second question, you asked about the Hawa, the idea of, I mean, yes, absolutely. Coming out of every voting day, you know, we're going to have seven phases of these. The politicians come out and say, we know that we've done super well. We've won this round, you know, and it's clearly going well. And one of the reasons for doing this is the first past the post system, because, you know, if it was proportional, it in a way wouldn't matter, because parties that have a lot of support would get a lot of support and see reflections in the parliament accordingly. But because first past the post system, you know, really gives this huge bias in favor of a winner, you tend to see what some people have called a bandwagon effect or a winner effect, where people want to vote for who's likely to win. And it's harder to understand, I think, for people familiar with just two-party systems. But in India, we have lots and lots of parties and lots of people you can give your votes to. And so folks are often making decisions based on this. We've had big cases where people have said, you know, we totally won this round, and then results afterwards are a much more mixed picture.
The other question I had was about how that really long election process affects how the main parties campaign, because you know where people are going to be voting at different times. And does that mean that you will have a campaign where, I mean, hypothetically, if rural areas going first, you would lead off your campaign with the policies that you've got that would particularly support rural voters, and then later on you have you know, more urban ones? I don't know quite how that divide is, but do the parties think about that when they work out what they're announcing at different times, where they're going? Or is it just, we'll send our party leader to this place where they're voting today and to that place where they're voting next week and so on?
So this is partly, you know, the opposition have come out and said that the length of this election will favor the BJP. And I'll explain that, and it's connected to your question. The simple answer is no, not exactly. Parties don't necessarily put things out specifically, just because, again, with India's spread, every phase has a whole bunch of different. It's not just rural. It's not just north. It's not just, you know, upper class. It's just really a big geographic spread. The same state, for example, the state of Uttar Pradesh with 200 million people is voting on all seven of those phases. It's not like you block off one entire state and finish off. the allegation in this case, you know, 2 decades ago, India was having around 20-something day elections. Now we're having a 44-day election. And the allegation from the opposition is that the length benefits a party that has deeper pockets because they can spend more time campaigning, throwing money into advertising and so on over the course of that. And of course, specifically in this case, because the BJP runs a very centralized campaign where Modi is who you're voting for, a longer campaign allows him to go around to more places and to shore up support rather than relying more on regional leaders and so on.
Sure.
It gives him more space to travel around the country. So this has been the allegation for why it favors the ruling party. Of course, the response from the ruling party is that, you know, the other side has the same advantages or disadvantages that we have. It's as long as it needs to be for everyone. It's not longer or shorter for anyone. But if you do look at it, given that they do have deeper pockets, a longer campaign definitely benefits the party that that has more money and a marketable face.
Are there certain states that you think are particularly important to watch, or that you know that the BJP and Congress or whichever party really want to win? And do you know where in the election cycle they fall?
And we can probably talk about these a bit closer to you know, as this is happening. About a third of the contests in this election will be BJP versus Congress. But that's only a third. There's a lot more seats. And, you know, there's another third is, or another quarter is regional party versus regional party without even the BJP or the Congress involved. And so you have lots of little bits and pieces. The big states really for us to watch are across the seven phases, or in some cases, five phases. But there's no one big day, or as you get towards the end of the seven phases, some of them have been ticked off completely. The ones to watch, UP is the obvious one, and that's the big, you know, without that, it's hard for you to win.
And UP is the most populous state in the country, is that right?
Yes. Uttar Pradesh is 200 million people. It's where Modi himself contests from, Banaras, Varanasi. It's the heartland, so to speak, both culturally, religiously, and in terms of testing out political ideas. So that's a classic one. But maybe given the context of this election particularly, I could point out three others. One would be the western state of Maharashtra, where Mumbai is located, where it's likely going to be a multi-cornered contest where there's numerous parties, the BJP with the allies, the Congress with allies, plus a bunch of local players. And so you have a much more one where the BJP has never won a majority. And so it's the big question is how far the Modi phenomenon can take the BJP. Another is, for example, Tamil Nadu in the south, where an anti-North Indian or anti-BJP strain of politics is very strong. It's not built on being opposed to the North, but it's built on parochialism for the South, let's say. And the BJP is for long trying to enter this space. And whether the BJP can will be one of those big questions. And the third I'll mention is one that we started off on this show, Bihar, where we spoke about Nitish Kumar, who jumped ship. The reason he jumped ship, the reason the BJP accepted him, is also because they were not sure that they would necessarily be doing well in this core, again, Hindi heartland state, but one where the BJP has often struggled to win beyond a certain amount of votes. So these three are ones that I would watch. Of course, each one of them come with loads and loads of storylines within them. One of the things that's really relevant for the Indian elections is the difference between being able to estimate vote shares versus seat share. So it's good for pollsters to really be able to tell us how many votes people are going to pull in. Broadly speaking, very hard to convert that into how many seats they could actually win because of the first-past-the-post system. And given that the UK has, you know, somewhat of the same approach, I was curious if that's something that's a feature of your elections out there in the UK, where we can tell how much support they're likely to get, but how does it convert into results in the parliament?
Yeah, I mean, there's always a difference between the national opinion polls and the results in individual seats. And people will always feed the results of polls into sort of a uniform swing calculator, which will never quite reflect what happens. But to be fair, it's good enough, especially, frankly, when the polls are as they are at the moment, when you've got one party with a big lead, you can be pretty confident that the party that has, you know, if the party's 20 points ahead, they're going to win whatever happens. I think when you get to really close elections, it can go either way. One thing I was going to say, resulting from that conversation and the fact that we now know when the Indian election is, we've always known when the US election is from, I don't know, possibly from almost the writing of the Constitution. We've known that the 2024 election
we've
is due.
We've always known.
The UK election is now the only one where we do not know the date yet. And it emerged that this was the last week when the Prime Minister could have called an election for May. So he hasn't done that. We now know there won't be an election in May, but we still don't know whether it's going to be October or November or potentially January or potentially June, but that would be mad, or potentially December, but that would be mad. But we're still waiting to see. So we're the last ones to call our election.
So from the outside, it's like the Tories get to decide, or the party in power has to call the election. Yeah. If you're in power and you think you're going to lose, why would you not call it for the last possible moment? Because maybe you never know, things could change. Maybe the economy starts booming. Everybody loves Rishi Sunak again. You know, like, is it not in the interest of the party in power to just wait it out and call it, you know,
yeah,
wait to call it?
Basically, yeah. And that's what always happens. And if you go back through sort of British political history, basically you either have parties that go well before the five-year limit because they're well ahead, they think they can win, or you have parties that take it right to the end because they're behind and they hope that something will turn up. And the only real exception to that is from 2010 to 15, well, actually from 2010 to 18 or 19, but there were weird legislative things going on. We had something called the Fixed Term Parliament Act, which means that the power was taken out of the Prime Minister's hands. So in the 2010 Parliament, we knew all along that the election would be in May 2015, unless something happened and the government collapsed, which was never very likely.
I may be misremembering, but I seem to remember that Theresa May called early elections because she thought, oh, I'm in such great shape, I'm going to strengthen my grip on power. And then it, you know,
yeah,
again, things changed.
That's totally right. Yeah, there were three things that came together at once. One was that she had a very small majority, actually. Although the Tories had won the 2015 election, they won with a majority of about 12 seats. So they didn't have a huge amount of space. And then Labour had elected a leader who at that point was very unpopular. And the Tories had a big lead. So they thought, this is a free election win. We'll just go for it. And you could override the Fixed Term Parliament Act with enough votes in Parliament. And the calculation was the Tories would all vote for it. Labour couldn't vote against an election because it would look like they were scared. So everyone voted for an election. And as it happened, Labour performed way better than the polls suggested. And Theresa May lost a majority, although she did stay in power. So yes, the 2017 and 2019 elections were both after about 2 years from a previous election. We've had loads of elections in recent years, but this one finally is going to go long.
Listeners, if you just heard my dog's collar shake, I apologize. She's just really passionate about British elections.
And so she should be.
As who isn't? She's an election tricycle listener. Okay. So I guess last question for our main section for Rohan, like, what happens now between now and April 19th? They're just like, what do the parties do in these last 3 weeks before voting starts, besides try to do a good job campaigning and not a bad job?
Well, you have rolling periods where parties can announce their candidates. People can actually go and register for each of the phases. So we're just coming up to the end of the nomination period for the first phase of voting. So parties could potentially change even their candidates. In some cases, you have, as Tom suggested, you have some news events that end up reflecting in what happens afterwards, and people might have to rearrange their planning for the rest of the election based on that. What you basically have is number crunching from the war room, so to speak, trying to figure out where will be the most impact in terms of campaigning. And then just in the days before the elections, you have a cooling off period where there's not supposed to be any campaigning in that constituency right before the voting, although in this day and age of social media and you know, mass broadcast media, that's becoming less and less useful. And then, of course, you have people calling out to the election commission saying this person broke some rule, attempts to bring in the Supreme Court or the commission in saying that folks are violating something of spending or a certain rule of campaigning and so on. So it's really a big, messy period. With this long election, it's also one where we're going to have an extremely hot election. May and June are horribly hot in most parts of India. And so the length for voters, for campaigners, and for journalists, it's going to be really, really tough this season.
Okay. Well, regular listeners, we have to leave it there. Rohan, thank you so much for that. I've learned a lot. Listeners, I hope you did as well. I will not be here next week because I am on vacation, aka holiday, but we will have, I think, a special guest in my stead. So definitely check back next week for that. Like, subscribe, tell a friend, tell a hater. Regular listeners, thank you so much. We will talk to you next week.
The Election Tricycle is a Poddo podcast hosted by Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin, and Rohan Venkat. It is series produced by Nick Hilton. Tweet us at Tricycle2024. And watch a video version of the show at cooler.news. For sales and advertising, please email nick@podopods.com. podopods.com.